Episode log number 38, stardate 42625.4, The Royale.
Hailing frequencies open.
Hello, Trekkies, Trekkers, whatever you want to be called. Star Trek fans, welcome to Galaxy Class, a Star Trek the TNG podcast. I'm Kerry, your host, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Sherry and Kirk. Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
Now, last time, I said that I remembered this episode being a good one, and I hope I wouldn't be disappointed. I'm happy to say that I wasn't.
Yeah.
I do like this episode. Not everyone did, though, including the guy that wrote it. But we'll get to that. We're going to talk about The Royale today. This is one of these episodes that's sort of, and I think it might be the reason I like it so much. It's not a very action packed. Like it's a thin episode, but it's just fun.
Yeah,
Takes us off the Enterprise, puts them in another. It's like a Dixon Hill episode.
Yeah.
Puts us in another environment, and it's just a fun episode. I think it's a fun episode to watch.
Yeah,
I don't know. Now, not everybody might agree to that. It kind of got mixed reviews when it came out, and mixed reviews today. It's one of those episodes where you kind of run right down the middle. Some people like it, some people don't.
And you know what? I can sort of see that. I like the episode, but there are like a lot of little tiny things in this episode that are like...
Oh. I'm sure you're gonna
tell us. So I'll have to point those out for you.
So the episode was directed by Cliff Bohl and written by Tracy Torme, although the screen credit is Keith Mills, and we'll explain why later. It aired March 27th, 1989, and it guest starred Diana Muldaur as Dr. Pulaski, Sam Anderson as the assistant manager, Jill Jacobson as Vanessa, Leo Garcia as the bellboy, Noble Willingham as Texas, Gregory Beecroft as Mickey D., and Comini as Chief O'Brien.
The Enterprise enters the orbit of Theta 8 in order to investigate a report of a strange vessel in its atmosphere. Chief O'Brien finds a piece of wreckage with markings on it and is able to beam it on board. It is a piece of a NASA vessel. In the conference room, Data reports that the debris is terrestrial and from the mid-21st century. Picard doubts that could be true, since no ship from that time could have traveled this far from Earth. Theta 8 has an inhospitable atmosphere consisting of nitrogen, methane, liquid neon, a surface temperature of minus 291 degrees Celsius, and wind speeds of over 300 meters per second. However, Geordi and Wesley report that a structure has been found on the planet's surface in a pocket of breathable air. Riker, Data, and Worf beam down to investigate. On the surface, they find a revolving door. Data believes the building to be invisible. Upon entering the door, they find themselves in the middle of a bustling hotel casino. Data believes they should beam back to the ship, but Riker insists on investigating, as it seems that they are in no danger. The away team talks to the assistant manager, who tells them that this planet is Earth. Data begins scanning the hotel and discovers that none of the people are emitting life signs. Meanwhile, on the Enterprise, Geordi and Wesley are still attempting to regain the away team's signal, which was lost when they entered the door. Riker pulls Data away from his game of blackjack, insisting that they should leave. However, the revolving door simply turns them back into the casino. Annoyed, Riker instructs them to start looking for another way out. Their efforts are in vain, and Data reports that they are trapped. Data picks up human DNA on the tricorder, but when they arrive at the guest's room, only his skeleton remains. The body was Colonel S. Ritchie, who had been on board the ship orbiting the planet. The Enterprise is finally able to establish stable communications with the away team. Data reads the book that was on the nightstand, Hotel Royale, and Riker believes that it's the novel that's being played out around them. Riker finds a diary with only one entry. Colonel Ritchie was the sole survivor of an alien contaminant. He then found himself in the Hotel Royale, surviving there for 38 years. The aliens created the setting for him out of guilt, using the novel that was on the shuttle as a guide. Richie looked forward to dying as it would be a release from his terrible situation. They return to the hotel lobby. Mickey D enters the lobby and confronts the bellboy about Rita. As the bellboy starts to leave, Mickey shoots him, killing him. Mickey then leaves through the revolving door. Riker is stunned as to how he is able to leave. Picard had been listening in and summarized the end of the novel for Riker. The hotel is bought by foreign investors for $12.5 million, who then return home. Riker realizes that this is the way that they can make their escape, by buying the casino. Data believes he can win the required money at craps, and after fixing the loaded dice, does so. Picard warns Riker that the investors were flamboyantly generous, so they bet the full amount in order to spread some money around. Once they have more than enough money, they give it to the assistant manager and walk through the revolving door and beam back up to the ship.
This, hey, there was an awkward Riker stance, like, almost right away in this episode.
Yeah.
Take a drink.
And then I guess that NASA reveal in the cold open was supposed to be a big deal, too, when he turned the piece of debris around and it had the NASA logo.
Now, here's the very first thing that, well, not the very, very, very first thing, but it was one of the things I was like, okay, so they beamed an object aboard. They weren't sure of the markings. I'm sure that they have the sensors to be sure of those markings. Now, what if the markings were like a biological hazard marking or a caution radiation? You think you might want to know what that marking is before you know, I don't know.
Or even have it beam up so the markings are facing you, have it in a force field. I don't know.
Yeah. Something.
I think a little more precaution.
Now, Riker, just run up there and touch it with your hands.
So am I correct?
Yeah. Just lick it a little bit.
The sensors couldn't recognize the markings?
Yeah.
So they couldn't read the word NASA?
Or notice the flag with the stars and the stripes?
Yeah. Those A's are kind of messed up.
But you would just think that Starfleet would know the logo for the organization that sort of paved the way.
Yeah.
Centuries before, but paved the way for, you know, the whole travel into space type deal.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just a curiosity. I just think that would be a very recognizable logo, and they would all have probably seen it at least in a museum or perhaps during Starfleet training.
Yeah.
Like
a little bit of history, like
Space Travel 101, Chapter 1, NASA.
Because, well, at one point, the world, we're at the point where the world is governed by many bodies, and obviously they've come to the point where the world is governed by one body.
Yes.
You'd think that the bodies that existed before would have got, like, you know, five-second mention in history class. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there used to be these countries.
Yeah.
Like, well, they knew the flag.
Yeah, like if you would have looked up and
they knew it when they looked at it. It was just strange. Why wouldn't I don't understand.
Why wouldn't the computer?
Like if you would go to someone on that ship and say, "What was Sputnik?" Would they know what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. You know what? You know what's sad though.
Who was Laika?
You talk to anybody that's like 5-10 years younger than us, and they're like, I know. "Sputnik." What? Yeah.
Well, because traveling in the moon went out with thigh-high boots.
Yeah.
So,
Laika was the dog.
Oh yes. Yeah. Couldn't do that nowadays.
No, she died.
Now that ship.
She died in space.
Yeah, I know. She's still out there.
Yes.
Now, that's of course if you believe that they actually went to the moon. Anyway.
She's on the soundstage.
She's on the soundstage still. Yeah.
Just her skeleton.
So the ship was from the mid. The ship was from the mid 21st century. They said, right?
Yes. 2030
something. Well, 2030 something? Yeah. Okay, because I missed that because I was thinking 2063 was first contact. Well,
yeah, they said it was between 2032, and 2070.
So, yeah, because with the 52 stars on the flag. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, I did like when they beamed down to the surface, I did like the sort of it's like a dreamlike state of the planet where they had just those lights just overhead.
Yeah.
And it was all black where they were, obviously cheapening out. It was just a black sound stage with a door.
Really good, though.
Yeah,
but it did look really good. It was different looking, and it was You got the it was an aura of mystery right away as soon as they beamed down.
I thought it was sort of funny because they talk to Picard and they say, okay, well, you know, there's a storm raging, you know, 100 meters away. We can't hear anything, and there's a revolving door. And Picard's like, revolving door? Proceed with caution. Because, you know, nothing can come of good of a revolving door. There's always bad things on the other side of a revolving door.
Sherry made a good observation when we watched it, though. She said, why would they go in on a why wouldn't they try to go around the door first and see what was on the other side?
Yeah, since they couldn't see the structure.
I think they try to touch.
You think they would have tried something rather than just walking in. And what did Wesley call it? An ancient door?
Antique.
An antique door.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. They're almost becoming antique now. You don't see too many revolving doors.
No.
I don't know why, because they're fun.
Oh, yeah. You can always throw your friend halfway, like when it's just about to close.
Trap him in there. Trap him in there. I do like the Dixon Hill atmosphere and the really bad movie music.
Yeah.
Really bad 40s movie music.
Now, okay.
Are you going to bring this up now?
Yeah, okay. I think so. What time period did you think this was set in?
If I had to guess, I would have said it looked like the 50s.
Yeah. 40s or 50s, but right?
Texas tells Data that he has a 91 Cadillac.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, and then when Mickey D walks in, that is not a 1940s shirt that he's wearing.
No.
So I'm thinking it was just kind of a 40, which adds to the bad novel type of thing. I think it was set in like the 90s or 2000s or something like that. It was probably like with a 40s feel to it. Mm-hmm. So I think anyway, I don't think it was ever really.
Yeah. And I think there was a computer on the desk.
Yeah. So it was a computer on the desk, I believe. So it definitely was not the 40s, but it was made to feel like it, which. If it's a bad novel, that's a sure sign when you don't know what time period it's in.
Yeah. It was a dark and stormy night.
It was at night.
The front desk clerk is a charming chap, and he's one of those guys. He's in a lot of stuff. I've seen him in a lot of things, and he always has a bit part.
I had another problem immediately after they walked in.
Oh, really?
Okay, so now Data's like scanning the area, with his tricorder when he walks in.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the first thing you'd probably want to scan is the environment, make sure there's air in there that you can breathe.
Yeah.
Which you could determine relatively quickly, I would assume, with one of those things.
Or by the breathing that you're doing.
The ability to breathe. Yeah. Well, Data might not be able to notice that, but he can say, Riker, are you alive? Oh, well, that's good. The next thing I think I would be scanning would be the multitude of people there.
Yep.
Would be a possible threat. So I would definitely want to be scanning them. And he would obviously determine, because he determines it just like a couple minutes later, that they have no life signs. So that I would expect it. I would be upset that Data didn't come out to me. Like if I was right here, I'd be like, could have known that before we talked to the front desk guy.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been handy.
This episode is a classic, and it's one of the reasons I like it. It's a fish out of water story, because these three characters have no idea this time period what anything is
like. A casino?
Like.
They probably have never even heard of a casino.
Well, Worf with his turbo lifts.
That
was charming and amusing.
I like Data.
Data is the best thing about this episode, I think.
Absolutely.
I do like Worf's line, though, at the front desk, because Riker asks him... what planet is this? And he's in the front desk guy is like, it's Earth. What do you call it? And Torta's like, we call it Theta 8. How charming.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any fish out of water tale, if you have Worf in it, is going to be amusing because he's the most awkward of all the characters. But Data in this episode, really, I think Data really carries it. You latch on to Data's gambling, and then the funny little nuances he does, and the episode just becomes amusing, and it's because of Data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if he wasn't there, I don't know if it would be watchable. I don't think it would be.
No,
and you know what this thing could have done without? The whole bellhop thing.
Well, the whole
so didn't care
which,
about
which
him.
Is the plot of the book.
Yeah.
With the Royale story, and I don't mean the episode, I mean the story of the book, the Royale is terrible. When Data tells Picard the synopsis, I'm going, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. And that was another amusing scene when Data's telling the synopsis of the book.
Yeah.
Now, Sherry mentioned that she remembers being this freaking her out when she was a kid, and I can see it. The corpse in the bed was a little creepy for Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was like, what, 9 maybe when this was on? Yep.
Yeah.
Scary.
That tricorder is pretty impressive. It could tell that there was human DNA through probably multiple walls.
Yeah.
And over 30 meters away.
Yeah.
Sorry, a little earlier.
It's better than Wi-Fi.
Did you have a problem earlier with when there's no contact with them that Deanna can still feel their emotions? Do you have a problem with that? I kind of do.
Okay, I have a problem with the whole ESP thing in the first place. Well,
but she's a Betazoid.
So. Yeah, well, see. So, it really, it's boundless. Because
must be.
And they never say what it is that they're sensing, that they've technically found exactly what it is that this connection is. Yeah.
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 I don't know.
I don't know. If you have no contact, if your signals can't get through, then she shouldn't be able to read these people, I think. But
yeah.
I don't have ESP, so I don't know how strong it is for people that actually really have it.
Yeah. Because
I don't know if you could.
It's true.
I don't know if people could sense the sarcasm there, but it was present.
It's true. It's totally true.
Another part of this episode that I enjoyed was Worf talking on the phone.
Yes.
He'd be a great telemarketer. No. He'd be a great telemarketer, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah.
You'll buy this now or I'll...
Just pleasant on the phone. Just a pleasant conversation with that Worf fellow. And I love Picard's reaction when he begins to read the story. And he says it was a dark and stormy night. And then he kinda,
the grimace, yeah. The grimace. Great.
And he even says it doesn't sound promising, which is actually that's been used. I actually forgot to write it down what novel that was actually first used in.
Snoopy used that all the time whenever he was writing his novel.
It was used afterwards as an in-joke amongst everything.
Yeah.
Snoopy fans.
To designate a bad story. It would start with it was a dark and stormy night.
It's like the jump the shark of the novel world.
Pretty much.
Interesting. Pretty much. Colonel S. Ritchie, part of the third manned attempt.
Yeah.
To go past the solar system,
yeah.
Which is pretty strange because this is way past the solar system.
Yep.
These aliens, what's up with them? Right? If these people were in a manned pod, they'd be well within the area where human radio signals would be. They would be easily able to detect the radio signals and bring them back to Earth. No. Let's move hundreds of light years from where we are, which their spaceship obviously couldn't get from, and just like blast them, put them on a planet that's like just the shittiest piece of shit planet that you could ever want to live on, because like you couldn't unless you had some magic powers make a Hotel Royale for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now the whole final act of this episode and the final scenes I really, really like. I like this whole idea of the three of them actually being the three foreigners that come and purchase the hotel.
And finish the story.
I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah.
And that was where we also got our most amusing Data moments.
Mm-hmm.
The data playing craps is one of the funniest things, I think. Not what he's doing, but because it's Data doing it. You know?
Yeah.
What was it? Baby needs a new pair of shoes.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And he gets her to blow on the dice, but he holds it. His hand is so firm and so straight to hold the dice. Just little stuff like that. It was what made it great. If that would have been Riker doing it, it would have been laughed at.
Yeah.
Like as being stupid. Like Riker saying, Daddy needs a new pair of shoes.
Yeah.
Worf, it wouldn't have been believable.
No.
Like, Worf would never say that.
That's right.
But Data, it was just that right.
Or amount. He would have said, I could see him saying it, but very matter of fact.
Yeah.
Daddy needs a new pair of shoes.
Or sorry, baby needs a new pair of shoes. Baby, is what it is. Yes.
Baby needs a new pair of shoes.
And of course, Data fixing the loaded dice had to happen.
Yes.
In order for them to be successful.
Now,
I'm wondering here, did he just repair the dice?
Or did he repair the dice?
Yeah.
See, well, you know what? I don't even think you could roll 7 18 times in a row. So I think he repaired
the dice. But could Data, though? Could Data just have balanced them all properly and just know how to, the right amount, exactly the right amount of force?
He would have to, like place them in his hand and have like certain numbers up and certain numbers facing. Yeah. He'd have to have them placed the same way each time, right?
I would, that'd be interesting. And you know, you could set a rig up to test that. You could actually just get something that shoots at the same speed, like with an elastic or something.
Let's email Mythbusters.
Yeah.
Star Trek. Get them to do it. Star Trek myths.
Hey.
They've never done Star Trek myths, have they?
Well, it's kind of hard with the space.
Not all of them, though. Yeah. They could do some.
Yeah. Sure,
they did Star Wars myths.
Yeah,
sure they could do Star Trek ones. Should tell them to get on that. Let's call our friends Adam and Jamie because you know we know them and all. Good friends of ours.
Yeah,
and all. And I'm serious. You don't know.
I got a lock of Jamie's mustache.
It's under his pillow.
Yeah.
Riker does say a line here though, and says when the train rolls in, everybody rides.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that old guy's a little bipolar, though.
Texas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the end, he's like, and when Data told him to put the bet.
Yeah. Was it personal? Yeah. Well, no, you bet against me, dummy.
Was it because I didn't show you my car?
and then he's like, oh, let me buy you a round. I like you guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's that? Like, not, I don't think he had time to take in another breath to say that line.
Yeah. As I mentioned, this episode was thin. Like, there's not a whole lot to talk about of the actual episode because it's not a very deep episode. No. There's not a lot to analyze in here. It's pretty straightforward. But do you guys get the feeling this episode felt like an original series episode? Yeah. Like this scenario could have easily been Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
Mm-hmm.
Easily.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine Spock saying, "Baby needs a new pair of shoes," and snapping his fingers. Would have been hilarious.
Yes.
Now, Kirk, are there any? I know you got some scientific observations about this one.
Yes, there are some scientific observations.
You have a boo boo, don't you?
Yeah, big boo boo. Now, right at the beginning, it starts off basically with Geordi talking about this planet that they're investigating. And he mentions some things about the planet itself. First off, he mentions its temperature at minus 291 degrees Celsius. Now, I know exactly what you're thinking. How could that be possible? Because it's below absolute zero. And then how could you have liquid neon on there? That's actually, the liquid neon was the first thing that set me off. I didn't quite catch the fact that it was below absolute zero. Because I happen to know that neon has a really short range temperature where it can actually be liquid, which is actually between minus 248.59 degrees Celsius and minus 246.046, which is like about 2 degrees where liquid neon could exist. Of course, you could change that a little bit if you changed like the atmospheric pressure, right? Mm-hmm. Just like if you're boiling water here, say at ocean level, we all know that the boiling temperature of water is 100 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to the top of a high mountain range, you're going to find that the water is going to boil at a much lower temperature. You could even get to the top of Mount Everest, you could boil the water and drink it immediately after, and it would be cold because it would never actually be able to reach that 100 degrees Celsius. Because there's not enough pressure pushing down on it. So it boils off way faster before it even actually would get warm.
Huh.
So hot coffee is a no-go at those altitudes.
Wow.
Oh, all right.
And there was another thing. Right after that, Picard was talking about Pierre Fermat and his last theorem, which... It wasn't actually Pierre Fermat's theorem. It's actually Pythagoras's theorem and was a slight alteration to it. But he was just stating a fact, basically, that at what he thought at his time was a fact, that this equation couldn't be solved if the exponent n is over 2, and if you use positive integers for a squared plus b squared equals c squared, is basically what it's coming up, what he's talking about, that you can't solve it in whole numbers, but it actually ended up being solved sort of in 1994 by Andrew Wiles, who submitted his paper in 94 saying that he claimed to have solved it. But upon peer review, they found there was a mistake, so he took it back, got some help from a former student of his, and finished the paper a year later, resubmitted it. It was published in 1995, which was, what, 4 years after this episode? Yeah,
so Picard erred when he said that it hadn't been solved for 800 years.
Yeah. Anyway, to go on, Wiles ended up collecting multiple rewards for solving this. Over $1 million, from what I understand, and obviously got the fame behind it, saying that he was the one that solved this, 360-some-year-old problem.
Yeah. Now, for some reason here, I'm looking at my notes, and I didn't write down the episode, but that this theory here, this equation, is looked at again in a Deep Space Nine episode, also directed by Cliff Bull. Yeah. And they fix up Picard's statement there and make it a bit more accurate. So
yeah.
I forget exactly what it said. It's Dax that's discussing it and says something about the theory as someone saw it was never, or something like that. I don't know the exact details, but they fix it anyway.
But well,
read that somewhere.
Yeah. You know what I find the strangest thing about this? This Pierre Fermat, his claim to fame with this, and this is his most famous claim to fame, is this last theorem of his. It was discovered that he supposedly said that he had proof that he could solve this. They found that he had scrawled this message in the margin saying that he had proof that he could solve this, but there was not enough room for him to write it down in the margin. So I don't know. I guess paper was really short. But honestly, this guy just claimed to be able to solve this, and that's why he's famous.
Wow.
Is that the biggest bunch of bullshit you've ever heard? He didn't even make up the it's a squared. It's somebody else's mathematical equation, and he just claimed to be able to solve this particularly hard, and he didn't even do it. And now he's famous. Remembered forever.
You're nice.
Interesting.
The last occurrence of someone being famous for doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
Paris Hilton. Sorry.
Well, at least this guy isn't famous for porn.
Well, they're
he was into that too.
They just made famous porn. Well, yeah, Kardashian, but yeah.
And Paris Hilton.
But no, Paris wasn't famous because of porn. Paris made famous porn. She was already famous before the porn out. Yeah.
Oh.
She was famous because of her
money.
She was famous because of her daddy, the Hilton Hotels. Yes.
Why are we talking about these?
I don't know.
Assholes.
Is that it for your scientific observations, Kirk? All right. Now, I mentioned earlier in the episode that Tracy Torme wrote the episode, but had a pseudonym for the credits as Keith Mills. The reason for that is because he asked to have his name removed after the rewrites of this episode, because it was the story was very different. He has since disowned the episode. The original episode had the astronaut was and his image or whatever was still kept alive, and then a dead crew member, a woman, ends up joining him and staying with him, whose image is kept alive in the hotel and everything. And they just rewrote it, and it was rewritten by Maurice Hurley. And he rewrote it because he claimed that the original script was too derivative of the original series episode, A Piece of the Action, That's the one with the gangsters.
Yeah,
Sherry.
That's the one I immediately thought of.
So he didn't. He didn't want it to seem too similar. So that was why he changed it, and I guess Tracy Torme took great offense to that. So much so that he reduced his role on Star Trek. He became after this. He became a creative consultant. He did not want to have any more writing duties.
Wow, diva much?
He participated in one more episode before leaving the show. Huh. Now,
good riddance.
In his defense, very many executives at Paramount and director Cliff Bowl liked his original version more.
Yeah.
But you know what? But the original version wasn't the one that was made. And it's not like it was the first episode of this series to be completely different from its original concept.
Mm-hmm. We'd have to throw a hissy fit.
A little bit, eh? A little bit. Now, we don't know the details, obviously, but because we weren't there, maybe they called him a wiener or something and he just took offense.
Oh, maybe.
Could be. You never know. Yeah. Called Good him point. A name. Bad yeah. name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were mean to me. They were bullying me.
But so we're not going to see Tracy Torme much anymore. That's terrible.
I forgot something.
Uh-oh.
Some odds. Remember when he's playing blackjack with Tex there?
Yes.
And his first hand, which is not bad, Tex is talking about a 5-card Charlie.
Yes.
And the odds behind that, they're not that bad, really. 50-1 out of every 50 hands, on average, you're going to have one hand where you get 5 cards that total 21. Actually, that's not even the best hand. Now, a lot of casinos don't recognize the 5-card Charlie, 6-card Charlie. It actually goes up to, now I'm reading here that it goes up to a possible 10 cards that you could, but that's, they're saying that's 1 in 100 million hands.
Wow.
So that's not going to happen to you probably ever or anybody.
Unless you play a lot of blackjack.
Well,
because you'd need like, every one or every ace, probably every two, and then two threes.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, yeah, three 17, threes. 18, 19, 20, 21. Yeah.
So three threes. Okay. So, but
that's 11.
That's
cards.
11 cards.
Whoever wrote this is a liar.
Son of a bitch.
They're liars. There's an 11-card Charlie out there somewhere.
And I'm going to get it.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. But wouldn't it just be all the aces, all the twos, and...
And three threes.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's 11 cards.
Or a nine.
What?
Or a nine.
Yeah. Instead of three threes. Cool.
Or a six and a three. That would be a 10
yes,
card Charlie.
Yes.
Yeah, see, when you want to know about gambling, you come and see me because I know everything about gambling.
But an 11 card Charlie is possible.
Like it would yes, have to be.
Yes. Yes, it's not impossible. Yeah. It's highly improbable, but it's
yes.
not impossible. All right, Sherry, what do you rate this episode?
I don't know. Four?
Four?
Sure. I enjoyed it.
Sherry's been very lately with her ratings on this and on Damn It, Jim, on a podcast. She seems very just throwing her ratings out of there. Remember season one? She was like all analytical and was like, well, this would have made it a 3, but then this lost points because of this. So now it's a 2, but then they added a point. So it's going to give it a 2.5, and then it lost a point again for this. Now she's just like, yeah, 4. Why is that?
I'll give it 1 10-card Charlie.
1 10-card Charlie out of 5. Kirk?
I like the episode. I'm going to have to give it a 4. That's a decent rating for this. There's room to grow, but
yeah, it's one that I think if it was on TV, I was flipping through the channels and I saw this one on,
it's a
I'd
fun,
watch it.
Yeah, it's a fun episode.
For sure.
Yeah, 4 is all the way around. It's a fun It's a fun take.
Why are
off.
You so surprised when I gave it a 4?
No. I'm just surprised that you seem very flippant about your ratings now.
Okay.
I give it this. Yeah. But yeah, it's just one of those episodes that kind of takes you off the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Not entirely. But it does for the duration of the episodes. Puts a fish out of water, puts them in a situation that at first is inescapable.
It's like a totally non-threatening situation.
Yeah, it's a threatening situation where they're not in any kind of grave danger.
Yeah. But, like, they can get room service. They can eat. They can gamble. They can drink.
Yeah.
They're pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad.
They're just trapped and constantly watching Mickey D shoot this fuck face.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they also have a book they could read, although it doesn't appear that I'd want to.
You know what? I think just like as I was leaving, I think I'd turn around and just open fire on everybody in there.
Just for fun, eh?
Well,
for shits and giggles.
They're not alive.
Yeah, they're not going to hurt you.
Just be like, pew, pew, pew. I would just ruin
just target
that place.
Well, you could grab the gun now. From the bellboy.
Plus, Kirk says, I own the place now. I can do what I want.
Exactly.
Kill yous all.
Yeah.
All y'all.
Burn y'all. Burn y'all down in this damn place.
All right. So that's it for today. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Now, next time, we have a doppelganger come on board. And it's a serious one because it's a doppelganger of Captain Picard.
He's facing his duality.
Kind of. We hope you'll join us as we explore Time Squared. So until then, for Sherry and Kirk, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Hailing frequencies closed.
This has been a Naked Wizard Media production. Executive producer, Carrie Kinney. For more information, visit nakedwizardmedia.com.